Well, hello, I'm Steve Seal from Minnesota Public Radio, and it is great to welcome you to Policy and a Pint. We're calling this event here tonight Water, Water Everywhere, but I didn't call it that in the promo because I thought, it sounds so weird. I just called it Water, Water Everywhere? So it's you take your pick of titles. So again, thanks to Dayblock Brewing for having us. This is the 11th year of our... Of this series of Policy in a Pint in collaboration that we've done with the Citizens League. Minnesota Public Radio and the Citizens League are both member organizations. We hope that you will consider joining and or supporting both of those organizations. There are representatives of both around. I would be one. We thank you in advance for supporting, and we thank you for your support in general simply by coming out tonight and being... being concerned about this topic here tonight that we're talking about. I also want to thank Target Corporation for being our corporate sponsor once again this year. And if you want to be along in the Twitter conversation, the hashtag is PolicyPint. If you are not able to get to, if I'm not able to get to you on the mic tonight and you just want to send a question through Twitter, I might be able to get to you that way. So tonight's program is all about water, and it's part of Water Month at Minnesota Public Radio. We are exploring issues of water across all the services of MPR throughout April. Why are we doing this? Well, certainly more and more it's becoming clear that water is going to be one of the big issues of the 21st century. It's a more basic, necessary resource than most things, certainly than fossil fuels. Are we being proper stewards as human beings around the world for this precious thing? Obviously, in some ways, we're probably not. But how does Minnesota compare? And what are the threats that are coming down the road? What are successes? What are things that perhaps Minnesota is doing better than some other places? And finally, what can each one of us do? We want to talk about personal responsibility as well here tonight. So please help me welcome my guests, my illustrious parade of stars here who have decided to join us tonight, and hold our applause till the end. Shannon Lotthammer is from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Director of Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the MPCA. She's been in that position since 2012. Prior to that, she managed the Water Assessment and Environmental Information Section, which included the agency's Standards Development and Effluent Limit Setting Activities. One of my least favorite words in the English language. Shannon has also served in various positions with the MPCA and local government, and she has a Bachelor of Science in Biology, Master of Science in Ecology from the U. Steve Woods is from the Freshwater Society, and he has a great name, Steve Woods. It's like Mark Trail.
I will buy you another beer, Steve.
All right. It's like nature superhero guy, Steve Woods. He's worked for 12 years in the private sector, 14 in the public sector, and now just over 2 years into his gig in the nonprofit sector with the Freshwater Society, which is now in its fifth decade. They describe their mission as propelling the best water policy and research from around the country into action here in Minnesota. He's a professional civil engineer with a master's in public administration. Lark Weller is from the National Park Service. She is water quality coordinator at the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, which is a unit of the National Park Service. She works closely with park partners to minimize the negative impacts of human activities on the park's water resources. She is also co-author of the award-winning State of the River Report, which you can find at stateoftheriver.com, along with Friends of the Mississippi River. Lark enjoys the challenge of communicating complex water resource issues to people in non-technical ways. She speaks normal words about complex things, which is important. So please help me welcome all of our guests for taking the time out to be here tonight. If you have, if you've been to a Policy in a Pint before, you know how I like to run it. If you don't, this is how it works. First half hour, I talk to the guests. Second half hour or more if we have a lot of questions. And I hold the mic. Please do not try to grab the mic out of my hand. That's about it. And again, please don't forget, hashtag policy pint if you want to go that route. So here's my first question. Why is it important for me to know where my water comes from and where it goes? Isn't that somebody else's job? Isn't that somebody whose taxes, you know, I pay my taxes for somebody to worry about that, where my water comes from and where it goes? You want to start, Shannon?
Sure. Yeah, I can start. So I think for a couple of reasons, it's really important to know that. First of all, because the things that we do, the decisions that we make every day, affect our water quality in small ways and in large ways. And so by knowing where our water comes from and where it goes, that helps us think about what are the impacts that we're having or what are the benefits that we can create as well. I also think that it's really important from the standpoint of, you know, we don't have the same level of connection to water as we maybe did in the past. 100 years ago, people would go to their own well and bring up their own water and have a much more physical connection to the water resources that they depended on. So we need to have a better sense of knowing where those resources are, because it helps us think about, is there going to be enough there? And then what are the potential impacts that we're having, and how can I make sure that the decisions that I make help protect water for me and then for future generations as well?
Mm-hmm. Steve?
That was a pretty good answer.
Pretty good answer.
Yeah.
Steve Woods, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very little. I think one of the reasons we want to know is because people say, well, where else the nasty stuff, the gunk in the water come from? Well, it comes from upstream. If you want to know who cares about that, what comes out of the wastewater plant here from the effluent section gets taken in the water treatment plants down in St. Louis. They care greatly what we do upstream here.
Right.
And if you, to bring it more to home, if you're on a lake or you've got a cabin on a lake, you can do certain things on the lake shore to make things better, but you're awfully concerned about that entire 10 square miles of farmland and everything else that might be draining towards your lake. And so you kind of want to know what's upstream of you, and you kind of want to know where your water goes downstream because you want to be a good neighbor.
But so, but it's really about just being a good neighbor. I mean, that's... Isn't it, like I say, somebody else's job to worry about making sure all those details are covered?
That person got cut during the budget cuts of 2002.
I see. Lark.
Yeah, they started off with a point that you're going to become very tired of hearing from me tonight, that we need to really think about how each of our decisions is impacting our water resources down the road, and we can make choices that are impacting them more or less negatively. But I think it's really important to just call out what water is doing for us in our lives. It's our drinking water. The Mississippi River here in the Twin Cities is our drinking water source. Our flush water is cleaned and returned to the river. We used to not treat that and just return it directly to the river, and we killed everything in the river as a result. Of course, here in the Twin Cities, we make a ton of use of it as a recreational resource. People really understand the importance of getting out into nature to recreate and to, you know, restore ourselves. It's a community presence. It's a place to meet each other as a community. So I think it's an important part of our energy sector, agriculture. So I think it's really important both to be clear about all the uses that it provides in our lives, but also to be really clear about how each of us is impacting it with each choice we make each day.
So you mentioned something which is kind of key. You mentioned about how the Mississippi used to be far worse than it is now.
Yeah.
And we'll get into why that was and is, why there are differences. But given that, I'm kind of curious, why all of this talk about water in the community now? I mean, there's the Governor's Water Summit. There's all this renewed interest and activity. Why now? Aren't things better?
Do you want me to jump in?
Yeah,
on that?
Jump in.
And then I know that both Steve and Lark will add to that. But I think it's a couple of things. I think one of the things is that we know a lot more about our water quality than we used to. And a big part of that is because of things like the constitutional amendment that was passed in 2008. Thank you for everyone that participated in that process and voted. And, you know, Minnesotans voted to raise their taxes in order to have additional resources to put towards monitoring our water, to understand the quality, figuring out what strategies we need to put in place for protection and restoration, and then actually implementing practices to make those improvements, whether it's at wastewater treatment plants or on the land, with agricultural land and urban land. So I think that helped raise the awareness, and I think we know a lot more, and that in part has been driving, I think, some of the discussions that we've seen.
This is the legacy amendment that you're referring to. Boy, was that that long ago now, 2008? And it's going for how long? It's
25 years.
For 25 years, okay. Right. Yeah. So, yes, Steve? Okay, great. Where do we get most of our drinking water in the Twin Cities, by the way? Is it, do we get it from, by the way, we should say that because this is such a sprawling topic, we're really going to just kind of talk about the metro area here tonight. There are different issues that we deal with when we're up in greater Minnesota and we're up the river and whatnot. So we're probably going to stick mostly to the Twin Cities tonight. So are we getting our water in the Twin Cities as far as, drinking water? Let's just talk about that to begin with. From aquifers, from lakes. Where do we get our drinking water in the Twin Cities?
In the Twin Cities, primarily from the Mississippi River.
Okay, so now this is interesting because I recently learned a lot myself about how, if you're a lifelong Minnesotan, then you know this, but about how there was a time when the Mississippi River supported no life.
Right.
I mean, basically, it was so bad.
Right.
And what was the turning point on that?
Yeah, so we quote a 1926 survey that studied the river from St. Anthony Falls to Hastings and found two living fish in the river. So. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We've come a long way because we installed a wastewater treatment plant. We now treat our human waste. I think within 4 months of installing that plant, we started to see some recovery of life within the river. So that was a really important improvement. The Clean Water Act and some protections around industrial activities and urban activities in the 70s.
Now that 70s. Was, okay, 72?
Yep, right. Yep, 1972. So that was another important pivotal point.
Lark is correct that Minneapolis and St. Paul really are taking their water off the Mississippi River system. If you take a look at the entire Twin City metropolitan area, you see about 75% of the population is getting their water from groundwater sources, and 25% is coming from surface water.
Okay.
So the core cities are from the river, and the suburbs, by and large, are coming from groundwater. And that's also indicative statewide in Minnesota. It's about a 75-25 split statewide, so that holds up. One of the cool things about the history, John Anfinson, with the National Park Service, did a great paper about a year ago talking about the water sources here. He said that in right around 1900, Minneapolis was seeing 100 people a year dying from typhoid fever. And that they had have 1,000 cases a year. And at the time, City of St. Paul was always bragging up their water because they were killing far less people than Minneapolis's water was.
Far less, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Clean Water Act of 72 Clean Water Act is what it was, mm-hmm. which was the Nixon administration, oddly enough. Back in the day, you know, when odd things happened, and there was, when the Mississippi River itself was turned into a national park, which was in the 1980s.
Yeah.
That's right. Which was a bipartisan effort. Between Senator Dave Durenberger. I know this because I recently was part of a documentary that did this. So Senator Dave Durenberger, Republican, and Representative Bruce Vento,
right.
Democrat, bipartisan effort to turn the Twin Cities section of the Mississippi River into a national park, not a state park, but into a national park. And what are the benefits of that, of seeing our immediate portion of the Mississippi turned into a state park?
Yeah. National park.
I mean, a national park. Yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah.
Nice shot.
I knew what I meant. Yeah.
No, I think. Well, I think first of all, the documentary elicits, that was possible because the community really came together around the resource, and I think since then it sort of triggered this like, aha, yeah, we do love the Mississippi River, and it just seems as though the Twin Cities community has been flocking more and more to the Mississippi River. I mean, I think I'm not from here originally, and it's really fascinating to me how many of us drive over the river every day. Many of us, you know, it's just such a constant presence in our lives that we sometimes take it for granted. And I think sort of the designation of a national park is helping the local community, in addition to the national and international community, really kind of be keyed into, there's something really special here. It's been protected for a reason. We want to continue to protect it because we recognize its value. And we, as the National Park Service, we see visitors coming from China, from India, from all over the world, for conferences, for work, whatever. And what they want to do when they're here is go see the Mississippi River. They want to go touch the Mississippi River that the whole world knows and loves, and we just sometimes take for granted here.
So let's talk about the quality of the water. It certainly has improved, but is it good, or is there still a lot of room for improvement for our drinking water?
So it is good overall, actually. There are a lot of really good things about the quality, particularly of the Mississippi River, but even of our water bodies throughout the Twin Cities area. I think a number of them have actually improved. So we now see lakes that used to turn kind of green and scummy in August and nobody really wanted to swim there, that maybe it's now just the last 2 weeks in August instead of all of August. So it's not perfect yet. We still have progress to be made. But definitely there's been a lot of improvements. At the same time, we're seeing some new challenges. We have some new types of contaminants that we either didn't know about or in some cases just couldn't measure before. Thinking about things like pharmaceuticals, personal care products, things that we use as consumers that we send down the drain, they get to the wastewater treatment facility, which isn't necessarily designed to remove them, and there isn't necessarily technology that is perfectly effective to do that, and ultimately that gets into the river. So we still have progress to be made, both from the standpoint of, you know, looking at our quality, but then also thinking again about where does our water go to and what are the things that we might be doing that affect that, and think about, are there choices that we can make to make a difference?
Is there technology, though, that is being developed to handle, you know, like the pharmaceuticals and the microbeads and all these sorts of things that we hear more about these days, you know?
You know, there's a lot of research that's being done. Actually, the Civil Engineering Department at the University of Minnesota is quite a center of excellence for looking at wastewater treatment options and opportunities and what is the efficiency of various types of treatment. So certainly there are opportunities to look at treatment, but I also think that we need to think about the upstream end as well. We need to think about consumer choices. We need to think about, you know, what is going into products. Because we all know just from kind of our day-to-day activities that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. If we can stop it from going down the drain in the first place, it's going to be likely less expensive than trying to pull it out of wastewater in the end, if there even is technology that's available. And that comes down to us as consumers and really getting involved and understanding what is it about some of these chemicals that can have an impact and what are our options and alternatives.
One of the downsides of this is you mentioned the plastic microbeads. Well, mm-hmm. It would have been nice if we hadn't had to mount a multi-year campaign to try and get those out. It's just that somebody in the marketing department comes up with, hey, let's use this, or they come up with flushable wipes. They'd love to find that marketing person that came up with that, because they just absolutely clog up the wastewater plants, and it costs cities and municipalities just a ton of money to take those off their grit racks and everything else every year.
So, go ahead.
We're also doing research that with a partnership with the U.S. Geological Survey that is finding, so Steve just referenced a ban on microbeads, sort of in like facial products, consumer products. But what we're finding is that in the river itself, the microplastics that are present are more plastic fibers. So the microbead ban is a great start, but we need to also look at sort of other forms, and that's what we're finding more in the environment. So Shannon's point about really kind of being a little more critical about what these products are, what our needs are for these things in the first place, I think is well taken.
I want to do a little experiment. Let's talk about consumption here. Who knows, raise your hand if you know what your water bill was this month. I'm not raising my hand either. Okay. Do you guys find that people on average know what their water bill is? And I mean, what does that say about how we think about water?
Yeah. On average? No.
Yeah.
Nobody knows that. I mean,
everybody's talking, comparing notes right now. Okay, back up here. Eyes on us.
They're all saying, I don't know. Do you know?
I don't know. Do you know? I don't know.
One of the things I did for Freshwater Society back in December was I took my utility bills for the year, which thrilled my wife to no end, and published them. Don't do that.
Don't do that, yeah.
But took a look, and our household paid $131 last year for water for the entire year.
All year long.
All year long. We have basic cable, like the cheap 12-channel version because I'm an engineer and kind of didn't want to spend money on more channels. That was like 260.
Oh, yeah.
It's less than half the cost of basic cable. You start adding those things up. You know, energy was 800 for natural gas, 880 for electricity, 131 for all the drinking water I wanted. And we don't think about it because you turn on the tap, it comes out. It's magic.
Right. So the implication, it seems to me, from what you're saying, is that we should be charging more. Could we charge more?
That is up to the water utility providers. One of the things we've put in our most recent report, which came out really in the last week or so, says that we need more of the municipal utilities charging the full cost of water. By that, I mean, by full, I mean the amount that they already charge typically for pumping it up, treating it, storing it, and distributing it. But also, they should be including something there for modernizing their meters to go to smart meter systems. Put some incentives in for residential efficiency, some incentives in for industrial efficiencies that they keep their water-based industries, or maybe pull in a few from California. And bottom line is, manage their water supply in a way that halts the decline in their groundwater levels.
Okay, so this is getting interesting and sort of ominous the more that you talk about this. Are we, the possible scenario that we're looking at here then, if we continue with things as they are?
We're all going to die.
Are we
going to
die?
Actually, that's going to happen either way.
Yeah.
Not that ominous? Okay.
I can guarantee you that he's correct.
Yes.
Someday. Yes. So go ahead.
The Metropolitan Council and DNR have a lot of observation wells that are just sunk in to measure groundwater levels. And they tell us that about just over half of those wells in the Twin Cities area are showing long-term, multi-decade declines in groundwater levels. And you can't keep doing that, particularly if you want to keep adding population and adding industry and having economic growth that we all want. And so
there's a point
where they jump in and need to do something about that.
Absolutely, and I just want to add a couple points to the points that Steve's making. I think, you know, one thing that comes up when we're talking about utility rates is, what about folks that are lower income or on fixed incomes and can't kind of afford those costs? And there are options for utilities to look at to try to address that, like tiered rates that can kind of account for that. I think the other thing that we see, and, you know, the work that the Freshwater Society shows, that the work that utilities and cities and the DNR has done shows that too, is that if you look at water use rates in the winter and you look at it in the summer, it's a completely different picture. And what we're talking about is irrigation water, lawn watering. And so things that can be done, even not even to stop watering your lawn, but to do it more smartly. You know, to not water the sidewalk, to really actually figure out how to use those sensors so it doesn't turn on when it's raining. It's kind of a pain, I know, but there are smart people around that can actually kind of figure out how to do it. And, or, you know, don't put it on, just put it on a timer and do it every 2 days. Turn it on and off if you have an automatic system, and water just when you need to. So even before we look at things like, you know, making water much more reflective of the cost of the resource, even conservation kinds of things that can drive that, how are we using it, and make sure that we use it in a smart way so that when we need it for drinking water, and that use of drinking water is protected going into the future.
We just eliminated the waste. We'd be in great position. What Shannon was saying about our summer use, the average for the metropolitan area here is that we use 2.5 more times water in the summer than we do in the winter. 2.5 times.
And it's because of what was your phrase? We are the drug addicted green carpets.
Oh yeah.
Is that your turn of phrase? I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what we have. That's America, right? We want our drug addicted green carpets out in front of our houses. But go ahead.
I just to add what they have already shared. I think this is also another opportunity to expand the conversation around the sort of recognition that we all give to the role of water. I think the fact that it's so cheap makes it sort of invisible, as they've been speaking to. And if we're concerned about prices changing, I think for us to request and require a true conversation around the true costs and benefits of healthy water and sort of what the role of government is in that, or whoever is providing our water, we could certainly privatize that if we wanted to. But I think this sort of begs the question of having a much more authentic conversation around the true costs and benefits of water and the way that we're paying for it right now.
Let's talk about rivers, Lark. Now, we've talked about the vast improvement in the quality of the water in the Mississippi. But when you look at the Minnesota River, though, you have a very, very different situation. Now, what accounts for those differences?
Yeah, so the Minnesota River drains a largely agricultural portion of the state, and we have asked a lot of agriculture for more and more production, and we're facing, you know, we're paying the consequences in terms of sedimentation and fertilizer, nitrate, and phosphorus pollution in the Minnesota River, which empties into the Mississippi River. So we see the Minnesota River comes into our park about halfway through our boundaries. And in terms of water quality, we see a different river upstream of the confluence with the Minnesota than we do downstream. So it's really driving issues in the Mississippi as well. But the Minnesota itself is seeing a lot of sedimentation problems and phosphorus and nitrate pollution. Right now, Lake Pepin, which is a lake downstream of the Twin Cities, about 60, 70 miles, is filling in 10 times faster than its natural rate, and that's linked, 75% of that sediment is coming from the Minnesota Basin because of the sort of land use practices and changes that we've done within that agricultural basin over time.
So I would think that right there you've got a case study in how you would have conflicts between the need slash desire for a clean river and agriculture. That's like the flashpoint of conflict right there, it would seem to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a MinnPost article recently that described MPCA as the least popular state government agency. And is that because we're talking about, business versus...
Well, I think it's for a lot of different reasons. I mean, we're the agency that does a lot of the monitoring, although we work with a lot of different local groups to do that. So when there are problems, we're the ones that are pointing it out. Nobody really likes the messenger, so that can be a challenge. We're also, when it comes to point sources, we're a regulatory agency, which is also a challenge as well. I mean, I think to the point that Lark is making is so much of the quality of our water resources, it depends on the land use. And how we use the land and the practices that we have on the land really ends up impacting the water resources. And I would bet that all of us up here, I don't think that it's an either-or situation. It's not that we can either have agriculture and feed the world or we can have clean water. I'm an eternal optimist. I couldn't do this job if I wasn't. But I believe in, our ingenuity. I believe in our commitment to finding creative ways to solve problems. And there are great examples of things that are happening in agricultural areas in order to protect the water resources. But we need more of that. We need more options, and we need greater adoption. I think the buffer initiative and the buffer law that was passed last year is a great step in that direction, but we need to build on that and expand on that. And that involves all of us.
Describe what that is again, the buffer initiative, buffer law. What is that now?
Sure. So kind of in a nutshell, it's requiring for all public waterways that there is an area of land alongside the waterway that is put into perennial vegetation, so deep-rooted vegetation. So there's not, whether it's a development that happens right next to a waterway or a farm field right next to a waterway, that we leave an area that has cover or plants growing year-round in order to provide a filter for anything that's running off the land before it gets into that lake or that stream. That's not going to solve every single problem, but it certainly is going to make a big difference. And one of the things that we've seen with our monitoring data is that where we have buffers and where we have good buffers, we have better water quality. We have better fish communities and better bug communities. So it does make a difference.
So, Shannon, I got a question for you since Steve has left the stage.
It's your show now, man.
Oh, you got wireless. Shoot. Governor did this buffer initiative. Is that a single, a double, a triple, a home run, or a hit by pitch? What are we talking about here?
From my perspective, I think for me, it's a single. It's not going to get us all the way, but it's kind of a momentum-changing single. You know, when you're watching the Twins and nobody's gotten a hit for a long time and somebody finally gets on base and you're like, oh my gosh, we just won the game practically just because they got on base.
We're desperate. It's
now wait. I want to be careful not to make it sound like nobody's doing anything in agricultural lands as well. This is not about, all of people that practice one type of economic activity are bad and everybody else is good. There are great examples. We need to build on those because, you know, we need to build on that clean water ethic as the governor's been speaking about during the Water Action Week of the last week.
You know, we're going to talk about Flint. I got to ask you about that. So it seems like a wholesale breakdown in taking care of a water system, a wake-up call. I got everybody thinking about municipal water supplies, something that we all just assume, like I said at the beginning of the program, oh, somebody's taking care of that for me. Could that happen here?
Well, of course it could. It's highly, highly unlikely. I'm not privy to what went on in Flint, other than what I'm reading in the papers and hearing on the news reports, but water treatment engineers are just like, what the hell were they doing? I mean, water treatment is a chemistry problem. It depends on what your water source is. If you're taken from a river, it depends what's coming by the river that day. And they do different additives to keep the bad stuff out of our drinking water. In the case of Flint, it sounds like they skipped a no-brainer step that you include, which is include these orthophosphates that help keep lead from leaching out of lead pipes. As you go farther east in the country, you have a higher amount of lead pipes, typically between the street and the house. And that most communities handle that just fine day in and day out. Meanwhile, they're just doing a slow, like a 10-year program to try and replace those lead pipes in the more forward-thinking communities. It seems like we have a big blow-up like this of some sort, like once every generation. I mean, 1993, city of Milwaukee had a huge cryptosporidium outbreak, made 400,000 people ill, you know, and 100 of them died. And it's like this happens once a generation where it goes, oh, we can't shortcut that anymore. And then it seems like 30 years later, somebody tries to take a foolish shortcut. And I just don't think this community around here, our Department of Health, is going to take that type of shortcut.
Yeah, so that's one piece. I think the other thing that I talk about with Flint is that Governor Snyder was interested in privatizing their drinking water treatment. And so that could be something that could happen here. I mean, this is a question of what we believe the role of government to be, the price we're willing to pay for what are currently public goods, and is that something that we're happy with and willing to pay for and willing to pay maybe more than we're currently paying if the pressure was so great that we felt compelled to move to a private system. So I think there's certainly the practical and functional logistical side of the equation, but there's also that sort of social community conversation around what are we willing to pay for. I think a lot of times we're accustomed to a certain quality of life, and if we're not clear about what the true costs of that are, we should become clear on that so that we're aware of what we're going to have to maintain into the future.
Steve, do you want to repost to that because you're a big free market guy?
There are communities that have privatized and it's worked, and there's others where they've privatized and gone back. There's a huge amount of community values that come into this. I mean, a huge thing that you see in all sorts of water decisions are the trade-offs involved. What do you want? What are you willing to give up? And it's why we try to manage water on like a triple bottom line basis. Yeah, you want to make it so it's good for ecology and the environment, but you also want to do things like flood protection. You also want to have economic growth. And what you're trying to do is make every square foot of Minnesota, when you're putting money out in the landscape, you're trying to make that produce clean water, clean air, abundant fish and wildlife habitat, and so that each dollar is producing multiple benefits. And part of that is having clean water. And communities will always have that ability to choose what they wish to value higher than other things.
We're here at the Dayblock Brewing Company. I'm Steve Seal. It's Policy in a Pint, and we're talking about water. Take our first question.
So, living in the land of 10,000 lakes, we don't necessarily have a shortage of water, but there are other parts of America that are running out of water at a significant rate. And there have been talks about building a pipeline from the Great Lakes or Lake Superior to other areas of the country, namely the Southwest. Is that something you see as a realistic possibility? And if so, how would Minnesota cope with not only managing our own water supply, but the water supply of other Americans?
So I can maybe start with that, because particularly when it comes to the Great Lakes, that's a great question. And because of the some of the discussions that had happened along those lines back in the 90s and the 2000s, there was actually a compact that was entered into by the governors of all of the Great Lakes states, so there's 8 states that surround the Great Lakes, as well as the officials from the 2 provinces in Canada, and that Great Lake Compact basically prevents any entity, any municipality, any public body from taking water out of the Great Lakes Basin if they're not in the Great Lakes Basin. There's actually a decision right now up in Wisconsin about a particular community near Milwaukee, I believe, that has requested to be able to take water from one of the Great Lakes for their municipal use, and that municipality is actually outside of the drainage area of the Great Lakes. To do that, it actually requires a unanimous yes vote for all of the representatives from each of the states and also the 2 provinces. I believe it's in about 3 weeks or so that decision is going to be made as to whether or not that's going to be allowed. Good news is that there was this compact that was entered into that it requires a unanimous decision. Any one entity can say no, and that there really has been a lot of discussion about how do we make sure that we protect the Great Lakes, because it is the world's largest source of fresh water. We want to make sure that it's there not just for drinking water for the communities around it, but for all of the many values and uses that that water is used for, including just the fact that it's there, which there's value to that too.
A couple of details to toss in. It's 11,842 lakes, buddy. Okay. Secondly, this decision on the Waukesha diversion is coming up on May 23rd, and it'll be interesting to see how Governor Dayton votes on that. The city of Waukesha is asking for this water because their line of reasoning is that our groundwater is filled with radium. It's not safe to drink. The other side has some very compelling points about other things they could have done, but it's not a casual ask by any means. Shannon is absolutely right that it's awesome that the conversation is even happening and it wasn't just taken. Now, on the negative side, since that's my job up here tonight, is to say that will that compact hold up forever? No, it's been there almost a decade now, so it's really young. But count your congressional votes. California's running out of water. California's got like a kajillion representatives. Civics education isn't what it used to be. and so they might change the rules someday on us. That's possible.
I think those issues and questions, it's a great question, and I think those are great moments for us also to just, are we ever going to re-examine our assumptions around how much water we're using? Are we ever going to ask ourselves whether we could demand less for certain uses and practices in the first place? Maybe, maybe not, but those are good opportunities to raise those kinds of questions as well.
So environmental services is a concept that I'm sure you're all aware of, and I'm sure everybody here would love to know about.
So I need a little bit of clarification. Do you mean environmental services from like an economic valuation standpoint?
Yeah, or? Totally, right. Okay. So like if you dump something in the river, the company doesn't pay for it, but the river pays for it, technically.
Yeah, so what I understand that you're referring to is that, you know, over time we've not done as good of a job kind of as a society really of valuing the benefits that we get from our natural resources. So there's benefits from the standpoint of that they're there. There are benefits because we get to use them as humans in some way, whether it's as a waste disposal mechanism or for recreation and things like that. But then there's also just the processes that happen. My background is in ecology, and so learning a lot about, you know, how do rivers and lakes process different, or, you know, what happens in a river and a lake? What does a food chain look like? What does that mean from the standpoint of feeding other areas that we rely on as humans, whether it's for drinking water or because it's a source of food, things like that? And there's definitely a kind of a field of economics that is really starting to develop and develop more and more tools about valuing those ecosystem services or those natural resource and environmental services. At the state, at the PCA, we're getting a little bit better at that. We've actually, because of some legislation that passed and some funding that was provided to us this past legislative session, we've been able to bring on another, we have two economists now, which is a big deal for us, that can really help us better understand when we're developing standards, when we're developing regulatory requirements, things like that. Of course, everybody wants to know what the costs are. And we need to pay attention to the costs because we want to make sure that we're doing things in a cost-efficient way. But we also need to talk about what the benefits are. And those benefits include those environmental services and those ecosystem services. And we're getting better at figuring out how to factor that in.
Locally, the Nature Conservancy has been doing some work in northern Minnesota to kind of say, hey, what's an intact forest worth for sending clean water down the Mississippi towards us? So they're kind of the leaders in this area. And just to pivot a little bit on the economic argument and externalized costs, we sponsored a speaker from the Des Moines Water Utility. We've got high definition archive video on our website at freshwater.org. The guy's name was Bill Stowe. He came down and came up from Iowa and talked to our audience about how the 500,000 ratepayers of the Des Moines drinking water system were a little tired of paying all of the downstream costs for decisions that were being made upstream of them by several drainage districts that were dumping excess nitrates down their way. Essentially, here's a representative of 500,000 people going, why are we spending millions of dollars more just so that you can externalize your costs? We want to put that cost back on where the decision's being made. It's a landmark case that'll probably get settled through the Supreme Court about the time I'm retired.
All right, next question.
So I grew up in Colorado and watched my father try to grow Kentucky bluegrass for 20 years. But now in Denver, people are adopting these beautiful desertscapes as homeowners. Other than having a front yard filled with prairie grasses, what are the things that we can do that helps this whole process?
Great question.
So one of the simple things we can do, so one of the things that the more I'm in this field, the more troubles me is how disconnected we have become from thinking about our impacts on things, thinking about our connections to people and places. So one of the easy things you can do is choose a spot. I would prefer on the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, but choose a spot that you can really become connected to and really get to know it, and get to know it, get to know the people around it, get to know what's impacting it, and reconnect yourself to a place and start to think more honestly and long-term about how your decisions are impacting that place. I think when we, you know, sort of reinstitute an emotional connection in our lives to place and the people around that place, that's one way that we can really start to think more honestly about how we're impacting these resources.
And I think to add to that, you know, as we're making decisions about as homeowners and as landowners and things like that, I mean, sometimes it can feel really overwhelming. It's like, well, you know, do I do a rain barrel? Do I do a rain garden? Should I blow up my lawn and not have any grass at all? But I have kids that like to play catch, you know, and I really encourage people to not think about this as an all or nothing kind of deal. Just pick one thing. Maybe it's you put a rain barrel in this year and you use that to water your plants. Or maybe it's you've got a patch of grass that, you know, isn't growing very well and you can maybe turn that into an area with wood chips. That makes a difference. Even if it's just one thing, it makes a difference and it's something to build on. And so, you know, just pick it off one thing at a time.
If you were to take a look at what Minnesota looked like when the European settlers first came here, I mean, the whole landscape looked like the surface of a golf ball, just dimples everywhere in the landscape. And all those little casual puddles, some of them as large as 10 acres, huge puddles, water went into them and didn't go anywhere else. They were dead ends, and it tended to soak in. So to the extent that you can do something like route your downspouts into your lawn instead of down your driveway, have it all soak in. We've got a program called the Master Water Stewards Program that teaches people, recruits and trains people to go out and help neighborhoods manage water at the neighborhood level.
All right, next question.
You guys have talked a little bit about valuing water and the low cost of water bills, but what happens if we raise the price of water for communities that are already disadvantaged? And on the flip side, if I'm rich, does that mean I can use as much water as I want?
Right. Yeah. Aha, excellent question.
It is.
Research shows that having tiered pricing structures, by and large, won't change the use habits of most people. Some people, yes. Pretty much the guidance that you get out of all the professional societies on how to set municipal water pricing structures comes right out and says, we need to have exceptions for low-income families. I mean, it's not even one of those things that's really debated that much anymore. You want to come up with a way to help them out. But one of the things we saw in the news items coming out of California as they went through their crushing drought is like, one of the, like Orange County or something, just put in these astronomic fines for people who are still watering their lawns, and it became a status symbol. It's like, huh, I can afford to pay $10,000 fine. My neighbor with the Bentley can't, huh. You know, it was a status symbol, but they still had green grass. And so some people are gonna be able to keep paying those all the time. From my perspective, you want some conservation tiered structures, so some of the people will use less water. But the other reason to do it is so that the municipality can raise some additional money so that they can put in place some of these efficiency programs, leak detection programs. It's not uncommon for a city to have 20% of the water they're pumping up from 400 feet down disappear before it ever reaches a faucet, that it leaks 8 feet under the ground. The goal is to have less than 10% leaks in your municipal water system. Now, there are a couple stellar cities, well, more than a couple. There are a number of cities in town that have gone to these smart meter systems to say, hey, by looking at these smart meters so closely, we've been able to knock our leakage rates all the way down to like 2.5%. And I'm thinking like Woodbury and Shoreview both are in that class. But that's still a lot of water, and which is just wasted. And that's the easy part to try to close our future needs, is just quit wasting it.
I think it's a great question, and I thank you for raising it. I think the conversation around equity is one that we need to be having much more regularly and deeply and authentically. And I think it's important to recognize that we have systems and structures in place that have not been serving everybody equitably. And so to think about how to correct those is going to require a real culture change in sort of how we think about these as... Are these public goods? If so, if we have systems in place that haven't equitably been serving everybody, what do we do to adjust that to maintain or create a public good that truly is serving everybody? So I'm grateful to you for raising that question.
Hi, I was wondering if there were any lobbyists or any law-making concerns involving making it illegal to use herbicides and fertilizers on non-agricultural land, such as lawns, including the sale of the product in Home Depot and that places like that.
So there is a law that was passed a number of years ago, I want to say it was probably a good 10 to 15 years ago, that limits the use of fertilizer in the metropolitan area that has phosphorus, so not on agricultural lands. Phosphorus is the middle number when you look at the three numbers on the fertilizer. It's nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And so that law was put in place, but I believe it wasn't like a ban on the sale. It was more of a ban on the use. And so it really requires people to be knowledgeable about that and to kind of read the label. And I think that's important for all of us to think about as consumers, is to read the label. There are some exceptions to that for new lawns. If you've done a soil test and found that you have low phosphorus, which is very rare, but it does happen, there are opportunities then to use phosphorus fertilizer. As far as herbicides, I'm not aware of any, you know, bans, but there certainly are a lot of use restrictions around the use of herbicides, so they need to be used according to the label. The Department of Agriculture actually does a great job getting information out about both the phosphorus question with fertilizers and then also herbicide use, and they have a really strong pesticide and herbicide monitoring program, so you can get a lot of information from their website as well.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. So we have global warming, and it's changing the weather patterns in our rain events, and El Nino this year is no better indicator of that. How do you plan to handle aging infrastructure within municipalities, especially, I mean, within Minnesota, we think about, you know, we implement a catch basin or a detention basin, and then we don't think about it until, you know, it fails. So what is your plan to kind of handle aging infrastructure as a state and as a national level?
Wow.
You got a wow out of that one.
A couple things on how the climate shift is affecting Minnesota. Paul Huttner has some data that he shows, which shows that like Lake Osakis in central Minnesota has had 2 weeks less of ice cover. Since about the 1870s to now, they've had 2 weeks shorter of ice cover. Now, Minnesota is the number one state in the nation for warming in during the winter portion of the year. So it's very real for here. We're seeing change in precipitation patterns. Back when I was a little engineer, it used to be that a 100-year rainfall over 24 hours was considered to be 5.9 inches. Now it's 7.5. Part of that is due to the fact that I'm old. Part of that is due to having more data. And so what you're seeing is a number of the cities out there now are going, hey, we sized all our storm sewers and our treatment ponds that we see all over, and the ponds that you see that MnDOT puts in the clover leaves nowadays, those are all sized to take storms of, you know, a couple inches less than we've got now. And so they're kind of scrambling to figure out, how do we retrofit this? How do we adjust the outlets? How do we create a little more storage? Otherwise, we're going to be flooding out people who never should have been flooded.
And I think there's two ways that we can kind of get at that. One of the things Steve was talking about, you know, the potholed surface of the land and look for opportunities to kind of hold water on the land. That does two things. It both helps with water quality because you're filtering out pollutants. It also helps with the runoff question, even in the face of climate change. So, you know, I think we're going to have to think creatively and not just rely on those end of pipe basins to be our flood protection or to be our water quality. We're going to need to start to look at how do we get more storage up in the landscape, whether it's in parks, whether it's restoring wetlands, whether it's looking for, you know, opportunities in agricultural lands and even in our own houses to add more of that storage. The other thing that I want to point out is that question about aging infrastructure is also really timely from the standpoint of wastewater treatment and water treatment, because a lot of our water treatment and wastewater treatment facilities across the state were built in the 70s and the 80s using what at that time was about a 90% or a 70% cost share from the federal government. Then the state government kicked in about 20%. Local communities paid about 10% of the cost of building those facilities. A lot of those facilities are starting to age out. And so we have a lot of communities, you know, in the kind of the outer ring suburbs and then across Minnesota as a whole that are looking at needing to replace their water infrastructure, and it's expensive. And there's not the same kind of grants and loans available as there were in the past. In the core cities and kind of the first suburbs, we've got the Met Council that has the Met Council, you know, wastewater treatment infrastructure, and that really provides a lot of economies of scale. But when you get in those smaller communities, it's a real issue. You know, before the legislature right now, as a part of the governor's bonding package, is about a $220 million bonding request, that $167 million of that is to provide additional funding for these infrastructure needs. But that's really just the down payment on the need over time. I think it's anywhere between $7 and $11 billion what those needs are over the next 10 to 15 years for both water and wastewater. So we've got to look at how do we address this.
I look at it as the previous generation built all that stuff for us, and it's our turn to build it for the next generation. One of the things that came out of our friends at the Government Accounting Standards Board a few years ago was a requirement that cities start putting on their asset sheets what their infrastructure's worth. I saw a report for City of Edina a month or so ago. The cost of their infrastructure of streets, roads, pipes, sewers, all that stuff, water towers, is worth $550 million. So we're talking big dollars, and that's a city that doesn't have a wastewater plant because Met Council takes care of it. So we're talking $500 million. And so what they're doing, these systems all have life cycles of about 70 to 80 years. And okay, when was Edina built up? Just right around post-World War II. Guess what? It's all getting old at about the same time, and they've got a heck of a financing issue facing them. And so the smart cities are starting to do asset management programs. They're taking a look, and they're saying, well, if we have, I'll make up a number here, if we have 100 miles of roads, we better do at least 10 miles every year with a resurfacing or replacing of the structure, or we're just going to have a huge bill later on. And so we're seeing city managers be more thoughtful about forecasting the foreseeable deaths of these systems.
Thank you. So I was wondering, you brought up Governor Dayton's buffer rule, and I'm certainly not going to poo-poo the importance of that, but it's on top of all the tile drainage, and I'm studying systems in Minnesota River Valley that are pretty much 100% impacted by tile drainage. So what do you think the buffer-esque fix is for that? And what about that?
I can say generally we are conducting, as a state, we're conducting research on what some better drain-related practices could be in terms of holding more on the land and using those systems to allow us to also hold it on the land. So we need to, I think, continue to invest in that research and then promote getting it out onto the land. I think as community members, we can communicate the importance, you know, of using our public funds in that way.
Much of southern Minnesota has been replumbed, essentially, is what you're saying, with this underground drain tile that helps take water out of the soil. That's not natural, but it is it's really productive and it's profitable. And that's we've got a farm bill system that rewards the farmers, or Minnesota businessmen, if you want to call them that, for how they work in a global market to make this income. So the challenge we've got here is how do we hit that triple bottom line of environment, but also business, and things like flood control, because all that extra drain tile is changing the runoff response that we see in our rivers. So yeah, most of that water is going through a little 6-inch pipe right underneath the buffer, and it's not contacting it. But one of the cool things written into the buffer law was the alternative for landowners, instead of putting in that 50-foot strip of vegetation Shannon talked about, is to do alternative practices whereby they could do a water and sediment control basin back up in the field that might actually produce a lot more environmental benefits than a buffer strip would have. And so the hope with this, and that's what it is at this point because it's a brand new law, the hope is that a number of the landowners will avail themselves of that opportunity to do these alternative things because it fits their farming system better. It's more complementary with what they're doing now, and the environment will be a winner because of that.
And I just add that, you know, when Steve asked the question about, so is it a home run? Is it a single? That's really why, you know, my response is it's a single. It is a great first step. It is going to make a difference for our water resources, but it is not going to get us the whole way there. And part of that is because of things like drainage and drain tile, and we need to capitalize on the research that Lark's talking about and the opportunities of alternative practices that Steve's talking about to really put those other pieces in place and recognize that this is a system and we've got to kind of treat it like that. And again, it's not an either or. You know, I think we need to try to stay away from that polarizing, well, because you do this, that must mean you don't care, or that we can't have both. I really think we can have both, but we've got to be creative, we've got to be smart, we've got to understand where people are coming from and what their needs are, figure out where the common ground is, and then go there.
Time for just a couple more questions. Does anyone have one pertaining to the Mississippi?
Just really quickly, I need to get to the bottom of a friendly debate. What's your opinion on swimming in the Mississippi River?
Nice.
Aha, uh-huh, there was one right there.
Yes, so...
Which part?
Right.
Above the Minnesota,
well played. So in addition to watching out for the current, and not the radio station, but the river current, and
waiting an hour until after you eat.
And barge traffic. Barges can sneak up on you, man. I almost got killed by a barge sneaking up on me once. Anyway... people swim in the river. So what we recommend is there. It is impaired with excess bacteria, which is one of the primary things we would look at for safety around swimming in terms of health. It is impaired in various locations, so it's good to know kind of the status of the location you're going to. But in general, we suggest that you avoid swimming in the river 48 hours after a rainstorm because that's when all that pollution is going to flush into the river. So that would also include a rainstorm upstream of us, right? Because they're going to send that down to us. So always use extreme caution, safety, know your own personal, you know, health and conditions and the conditions around you. But for sure, avoid swimming in the river for 48 hours after a rainstorm.
All right, got time for one more question.
I have a question, but it's also sort of a statement. What I'm curious about is everybody in this room, I believe, has an immense capacity for creativity. And what I hear a lot of is talking about capital. And the river does not care about money. It does not care about numbers, and none of the lakes do. And my heart is racing because it drives me insane that everyone in this room does not represent who's going to be at this conversation in the very near future. And we're lucky and fortunate to be here. But I want us to think about using our creativity for how can we think outside of money and outside of the need to have this constant sense of our lives being easy. So that river is out there working every day. The trees are out there growing every day. What can we look to them for and take as inspiration? What can we look to First Nations people who had relationships with this land and this water for long, long time before we came along wanting to just simply extract it? I'm not trying to shun my own skin color or my own race, but I think that there is a lot that we need to look to and grow beyond. And I believe that we have the creativity to do that. So I just want to speak on behalf of something other than capital, that there's another possibility and that we should all think about that.
Yeah, thank you very much for bringing that up. Yeah, part of what I said earlier about my concern about sort of our disconnect from each other and from place is sort of around some of those same ideas. And, you know, one of my other responses to what we can all do is to sort of relearn how to have a conversation, because I think our disconnect from each other and our inability to have thoughtful conversations with each other is leading to the kind of dynamic that you're speaking to that I think is leading us, has led us to, and is continuing to lead us to trouble if we don't sort of get human again.
Yeah, this is actually really where I kind of wanted to leave us to, let's talk about what we can all go out and do as we leave this room. What do you want to leave people with that we haven't covered yet today? If you want to reiterate some of the things that we have discussed we've talked about things that you do through your organization, Steve, and you know, whatever you want to send us out the door with, you guys.
So I'll kick it off, just because then that means I don't have like the last word and I don't have to like, sum it up or anything. which is what Steve's here for, anyway. So, but a couple of things, I would hope people come away with this from is a sense of empowerment, okay? So there are things that we can do as individuals that do make a difference. It can be really sort of overwhelming sometimes to think about, well, what's the right thing? Or we've got lots of challenges that face us, whether it's about water quality or climate change or some of the environmental issues that we face. But there's a lot of opportunity for progress, and incremental progress is still progress. And so, you know, I think it's important to not let that overwhelm you. And again, pick something that you can do, that you can implement, whether it's getting involved or reading the label before you buy something and thinking about what that might mean, not using your toilet as a trash can, thinking about those flushable wipes. Yep, they go down, but they get stuck. And then also, you know, getting involved, doing the things that you're doing by becoming informed and being engaged and making sure that, you know, your governmental officials are representing you well, and that we're engaging in those kind of values discussions and those needs discussions that we talked about too, as far as, you know, disproportionate impacts and how do we make sure that we're all benefiting from the wonderful natural resources that we have and not just a select few. How do we make sure that that also continues into the future?
Want to go next?
Well, I was just not trying to have dead air. Sure, I'll go. So in addition to finding a place you love, like finding and fall in love with a place that you can like, you know, love and care for and see what that does in your life. But I think we can all become a little clearer about what it means to have a good life. We here in Minnesota, we have such, you know, language around the quality of life, and we should really know what that means. We should know what the true costs, what the true benefits are. We should be very clear about who is benefiting and who is not, and if that's okay, great, but if we would like for everybody to benefit, let's have a different conversation, because I think we can get there. We are the wealthiest people in history. We're the most well-educated people in history.
Shannon, you've said a number of times, I totally agree, there's no reason we can't have both. We're smart enough, we're wealthy enough, but I think we need to be more critical of ourselves and sort of demand that everybody's benefiting from these resources.
We're working with lake associations up in Otter Tail County this summer. And one of the messages that we put out there through the Healthy Lakes and Rivers program is fix your own lake. Fix your own neighborhood. Get involved at the local level. That's what we're doing with the Master Water Stewards program. Look it up on our website.
Which is?
Freshwater.org.
Okay.
Members are welcome. And what's going on with that program is like we've got 80 Master Water Stewards already. We've got another 70 that are gestating right now. We'll be graduating in a few months.
Tadpoles.
And wow, cool. And the projects that they put in the ground already are infiltrating over 1 million gallons a year. That's halfway to what the Twins Target Field is doing at 2 million a year. We hope to pass them in another 2 years, I suppose, and then we'll see how Target Field ups their game. The point is, this is one of those things that you can make a difference within your quarter acre lot or in the park in your neighborhood by talking with your city council that so that the city park is well managed and the city park isn't watering during the middle of a thunderstorm. Mm. There's a lot of tiny little things that can happen. And if I'm going to throw one other thing out there that's unconventional, file for office. Minnesota's Soil and Water Conservation Districts will file for office to be on one of the five people on the board for that. That filing window runs from May 17 to May 31 in everywhere except Hennepin County. And the point with it is these are five-member boards of citizens who got involved because they care, and they've got budgets ranging from about $500,000 a year to up to about $1.5 million a year, and they're working with landowners. They're pulling in grant dollars into their community, and they're helping good things happen from the neighborhood scale to the more system-wide scale. And there's a lot of really good people on those boards, and you could be one of them.
Shannon Lothammer from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Steve Woods from the Freshwater Society, and Lark Weller from the National Park Service. Can we have a round of applause for all of our guests tonight? Thank you guys so much for coming out tonight. I want to thank Dayblock Brewing for being our hosts tonight for the first time. Thanks so much for having us, you guys. Once again, this year, we are very indebted to Target Corporation for being our corporate sponsor. Citizens League and 89.3, the current Minnesota Public Radio. We have produced Policy in a Pint for 11 years. We are member organizations as well, and we thank you very, very much for supporting us. From the Citizens League, I want to say big thanks to Sean Kershaw, Pahua Hoffman, and Jan Unstead. From Minnesota Public Radio, a producer, Jane Solinger, and a special note tonight to... just the person on the NPR side who basically made this program happen, and this is the last time she's with us here tonight after 11 years. The Citizens League has been doing events kind of like this before the Current came along 11 years ago and joined up with them. But on the Minnesota Public Radio side, there's been someone who has been the steward and the shepherd and the guiding light of Policy in a Pint ever since the beginning, and that is Ali Lozoff. And I want to thank you very much. Thank you, Allie. She's going on to bigger things at Minnesota Public Radio, and we will miss her at Policy in a Pint. My name is Steve Seal, and thank you so much for being here tonight. We'll see you next time, and good night. Well done.